258.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross-sort, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us.
Across the sea of space, the stars are other suns. We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. Tis I, Dawn, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. This week's wine is about the great Facebook experiment. Many of you may now be aware that Facebook has been experimenting on you without explicit consent. It has the EULA, or the End User License Agreement, that we all just sort of click on when we really don't really read it at all. So I guess it does seem to have an implicit consent, I guess. Much of the talk has been focused on the full rage about another corporation manipulating people for its own aims. But I could not help but notice, but the real story was somehow being missed. You see, what Facebook did was manipulate your feed so that you would see more positive or negative posts. The goal was to see whether this would affect your own posting. Now, the commentary all focused on two points. One, how much control we've given over to these mega daddy corporations, and doesn't this make you angry? There was some rage about how they may have used our personal information without us knowing it, but Facebook claims it went through a proper procedure to ensure that all data was anonymized. Much comparison was made to Google. The other stream, which was intended to diffuse the rage created in the first point, is that everyone is doing it. Then they would say, well, the CBC will alter the color of its logo, change the arrangements of web elements, write stories in different ways, all of which is data used to improve the site or increase its traffic. Fair enough, but there is one point, a major point, being overlooked. They manipulated your news feeds. What is a news feed? Well, to be honest, in most other contexts, it's like a streaming Google search. In that context, most of us know that based on our past searches, any future search will be edited, manipulated, so as to reflect our interests and their economic goals. But a Facebook newsfeed is not like newsfeeds you get from the CBC, where I trust them to send me what they think I would like to see. A Facebook newsfeed is from people, groups, and pages I subscribe to. It's not passive, but active. It's not their content, but our content. The real analogy is not the CBC News or Google, but Canada Post. So when they say they manipulated my feed, what they are really saying is they opened up all the mail sent to me. Then they tossed those that were, for example, positive. Not all, but enough for the experiment. Then they resealed the letters and sent them on to me. That is not experimentation. That's censoring my mail or email. Did my cousin have a baby? I might not know because I had reached my positive quota for that day. Your grandma died and I didn't send my condolences? Sorry, but my negative quota was reached. Let me reiterate, a Facebook newsfeed is not news, but messages sent to me by my request and the posters. It's not Facebook's content. It's our content. And that should really piss people off. And why didn't anybody else pick up on this? I asked my fellow Facebook users, and what did they say? Silence. Okay, the conspiracy person inside of me seriously wonders if maybe that posting was censored in itself. So then I asked a few friends, and I was gobsmacked. They said, oh yeah, what was the problem again? I said, how do you feel that Facebook was editing your status feeds? The response of one is to go into a long debate about how they were not editing the feeds, but just deleting them. What the feck? So to be clear, they were not editing the actual comments, but they were editing the feed itself. That is, some updates got thrown, others did not. Then they quibbled about the mail analogy, that if I sent a message directly to you, and that would not be on the feed, well, that would go through. So what was the problem? If I really wanted to know what you had said, I could go to your own personal page and see all the postings there. The reply is to point out that updates are like mass emails to your friends. So again, I do not understand why there is not a sliver of concern. Something. But no, it was just meh. Then I comment that maybe it's a generational thing, that the concept of privacy has a very different meaning. They replied, sadly accurately, that there's no such thing as privacy anymore. It's more than that. This is an absence of freedom, the willing abdication of the right to do or say as you wish, and the apathy to no longer care. The clinking sound as the chain closes around the necks of the next generation. What's your comments on this? Am I really that out of it? Send your comments to info@radiofreethinker.com or post them on our Facebook page. I'd really like to know what's up. So, from Facebook to Snowden, 1 year later. It's been over a year now since the world learned about Edward Snowden and the depth and breadth of the surveillance state. These revelations have made the worst aspects of 1984 seem like child's play. So just a recap of who Edward Snowden is. He's an American citizen who tried to join the fight against terrorism in 2004 by attempting to join the United States Armed Reserve. Due to medical conditions, he could not enlist, so chose instead to educate himself and join the Electronic Army. He was a high-level systems administrator at the CIA. He did counterintelligence training for the U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency. In 2010, Snowden left the government to work for the government, but with Dell, as a major NSA contractor. It seems this move, in hindsight, was a sign Snowden had given up trying to reform from the inside and was preparing to blow the whistle on U.S. illegal and/or unethical activities. He left Dell to work for Booz Allen just 3 months before disappearing in Hawaii and reappearing June 9, 2013 in the now famous interview with award-winning Glenn Greenwald, at the time a journalist for The Guardian. So what have we learned from the Snowden disclosures? If I listed all of them, we would be here for more than hours, tens of hours, but here are some of the highlights. Well, first, for Canadians, we were reminded of the Five Eyes, as in seeing eyes, that Canada, along with the US, the UK, Australia, and New Zealand, have since World War II acted as sort of one integrated surveillance agency. Of course, that was not unknown, but it was, I think, forgotten. And that's important because although the majority of the revelations deal with the US's NSA and the UK's GHCQ, our own CSEC and CSIS are right there in the middle and just as complacent. So there was the PRISM surveillance program, which collected the emails, voice, text, and video chats of foreigners and an unknown number of Americans from Microsoft, Google, Yahoo, Apple, and other tech giants. Stateroom, a highly secretive signal intelligence collection program involving the interception of international radio, telecommunication, and internet traffic. It was under this program that the U.S. tapped, not uniquely, German Chancellor Angela Merkel's phone, a revelation that has pushed the Germans to cancel a telecommunication contract with American Verizon over security concerns. Well, duh! Tempora used intercepts on the fiber optic cables that make up the backbone of the internet to gain access to large amount of internet users' personal data. The intercepts are placed in the United Kingdom and overseas with the knowledge of companies owning either the cables or the landing stations. Which brings up an important point that much of the surveillance has been done with the willing or coerced cooperation of corporations. Much of the data spying is done under contract via private corporations. And at least in a few instances, the spying seems to be done for those corporations. I remind everyone of the, quote, experimentation of collecting data in Canada did in Brazil just when we were negotiating a trade deal with their oil company. Under Britain's muscular program, the NSA and the GCHQ have secretly broken into the main communication links that connect Yahoo and Google data centers around the world, thereby gaining the ability to collect metadata and content at will from hundreds of millions of user accounts. According to Snowden, quote, the X-Keyscore program allows an analyst to read anyone's email in the world, anybody you've got an email address for, any website. You can watch traffic to and from it, any computer that an individual sits at. You can watch it, any laptop that you're tracking. You can follow it as it moves from place to place throughout the world. It's one-stop shopping for access for the NSA's information. Even low-level NSA analysts can, via systems like X-Keyscore, listen to whatever emails they want, whether telephone calls, browsing histories, Microsoft Word documents, and it's all done with no need to go to the court, with no need to even get supervisor's approval on the part of the analyst. So how is this possible? Beyond the real-time data, there is a program called Boundless Informant that, according to the NSA, collects it all, tags it, and stores it all. It is the reason that the NSA is building the world's largest data farm in Nevada. It is also the story that proves the agency's officials are not only lying to the public, but perjuring themselves to the government. One might remember on June 6, 2013, Director of National Intelligence James Clapper testifying before Congress. He said,
"Does the NSA collect any type of data at all on millions or hundreds of millions of Americans?"
"No, sir."
"It does not."
"Not wittingly. There are cases where they could inadvertently, perhaps, collect, but not wittingly."
Then, thanks to the Snowden revelations, this was proven false. Clapper reappeared in interviews, and then his story changed a little bit, and he said,
"I have great respect for Senator Wyden. I thought, though, in retrospect, I was asked, when are you going to stop beating your wife kind of question, which is meaning not answerable necessarily by a simple yes or no. So I responded in what I thought was the most truthful or least untruthful manner by saying no."
There are a few other gems, like attempting to undermine or place backdoors into security protocols, software, and the like. Okay, that's what was revealed. How is it received? Well, you had the classic three-way divide. Those on the left, libertarian, liberal, and socialist alike, decrying the surveillance state and the disappearance of privacy. They heralded Snowden as a whistleblower and a hero. Those of the right, a small number of people who claimed not only do we need these programs, but Snowden is directly responsible for the deaths of Americans, though no one has yet pointed to even one death. They also were calling for not only the prosecution and execution of Snowden, but for those journalists who reported on his revelations. Then there's the middle third, the majority. Much of the discussion here has been, well, if I may share my bias, naive and ill-informed. How many times have you heard, and I can't count the number of times I've heard this, someone saying, well, if you have nothing to hide, what does it matter? First off, if someone says this to you, and I stole this from Glenn Greenwald, give them your email address and ask them to send their email, online storage, and social media accounts complete with their passwords. If they have nothing to hide, they shouldn't mind if you take a look around. You would be surprised at how many people have declined this offer and suddenly feel that their privacy does have value. Beyond that, and I mean to be fair, people perhaps trust the government more than they might trust me. Well, at least in Canada, it is borderline incredulous that Americans refuse to have any monitoring of gun sales because they fear the government will use that information to take away their guns when the U.S. government goes fascist, and yet they allow it to become hyper-Orwellian in every other way. Sure, they can't keep a record of the gun sales, but they can keep every email you ever sent. Hope you didn't mention any of your gun purchases in those emails. But let's assume trust. There is always a possibility of misidentification, that your data trail gets confused or corrupted with someone else who does have something to hide. If governments are only allowed to spy on the suspicious, these errors are few and far between. But if they spy on everyone and everything, well, your chances of wrongful prosecution have increased by orders of magnitude. Of course, it's even worse if you happen to be the wrong cultural group. Which leads into another issue. What if someone who has access to this information just has it out for you, be it racial, personal, or other? I'm a vocal critic of this government. What if someone in CSEC hears about it? Is a loyal Harperite? Well, things could get ugly for me. I research many of the topics for the show. A pattern of, quote, questionable activities could be found. Why did I check out that terrorist site? When it turns out the website was a Gaza group, and I was looking into info about relief convoys, a secret government order could have me surveilled indefinitely. It could have me taken to jail without a trial. And what about those times when I sat there and I was investigating about toxic chemicals in our food? It could sound very suspicious to the right kind of ear, even though we all know that I'm a decent individual. You have to take my word on that, but I am. If I was in the U.S., I could experience prosecutorial overcharge. That is a common tactic where a prosecutor will charge someone with like 100 charges and then plea deal them down to say a dozen. The idea is to make it easier for an accused to just plead out than face the stress and expense of a lengthy trial. One they may lose, or so the prosecution ensures they believe. Or what about a jilted lover, or a friend of the guy that you pissed off at the bar? What havoc could they wreak if somehow those private sex pics make it into Facebook somehow mysteriously? Many of the accused know of selling out, but all the evidence shows this was a pure act of patriotism, irrespective of whether you agreed with his stance or not. But it brings up another point. Snowden has been working for the NSA and the CIA for years. He seems to have had access to unknown amounts of information. To this day, the U.S. government has no idea how much information he procured. And until there were the publications by Glenn Greenwald et al., they seemed to have no idea that he was taking this stuff. He could have been a possible leaker. One must wonder who else has this access. Are they all as noble, as patriotic as Snowden? How many others decided that their access was a ticket to a big payday and have sold out to the Russians, to the Chinese, to the famed Islamists? Beyond all this, the other elephant in the room is Hitler. One thing that is often lost to history is that Hitler's ascent to power was 95% legal. It was during the economic and political turmoil of the latter Weimar years that a democratic German government passed laws allowing for dictatorial powers to be vested in the president. A trusted, well-beloved, and patriotic Hindenburg, someone who genuinely had the best interests of the nation in mind. So at first, under exceptional circumstances, in 1930, the Chancellor got the president to use these powers to govern when Parliament could not. By the time Hitler came to power, this was a routine exercise of power. And when the office of president and chancellor were combined, well, you know the rest. The point being, we have set up a surveillance state. And so far, to the best of our knowledge, including the Snowden leaks, they've only been used in sort of the low-level evil. But what if the U.S. elects another Nixon or Hitler? All the groundwork for establishing authoritarian dictatorship has already been established within the reach that takes totalitarianism to a totally new level. So let us return. What's happened in this year of revelations? I've talked about the debate. It is much more on the minds of people. Some corporations, for fear of losing customers, have taken token efforts to resist. But with the sheer scope of the enterprise, the confluence of profitability of spying, and the financial corruption of U.S. politics, there seems to be no chance for any meaningful reform. And remember, one of the biggest differences between a company spying on you and the government spying on you is the government has the power of law. They can arrest you and throw you in jail. Google, as evil as it may be, lacks this power. That's why it's so important. And let us not forget Julian Assange, perhaps a more debatable hero, has just witnessed his second anniversary confined within the Ecuador embassy because of a very credible threat of extradition to the U.S. over WikiLeaks. Let us not forget Chelsea, formerly Bradley Manning, who exposed U.S. war crimes of opening fire on innocent bystanders and rescuers in Baghdad, inspired the Arab Spring that toppled a number of corrupt dictatorships, exposed the real situation of the war in Afghanistan and Iraq in the war logs. Manning, who was tortured, as in inhumane conditions. A sad state of affair when you must clarify what kind of torture the U.S. is using. Anyway, for well over a year, Manning was in a 6x12 cell, in isolation, subjected to sleep deprivation, psychological abuse from guards, denied clothing for long periods of time, ending up in a perfunctory trial where guilt was a foregone conclusion, and the use of the plea deal was again used. Manning may be the best answer to those who ask, why doesn't Snowden, if he's so sure that he's a hero, return to the U.S. and face trial? What a farce that would be. So, it's 1 year later. Nothing has really changed. People are more aware. What one might have said was, well, it couldn't be that bad. Well, it seems it is. Those who thought, yes, we all knew it was happening, found out that it was happening, but in a much bigger, deeper, and pernicious way than they ever could have imagined. I talked before about how the sales of the novel 1984 rose 10,000% upon the revelations of Snowden. At first, people might have thought it was a way of understanding how bad things may get. 1 year on, we read it and we think about how it was in the good old days, where at least one man found a moment of privacy. Ah, those were the days. We'll be back after this message.
Today in the news.
And today in the news.
Today in the news.
Tired of the same few voices giving you the same point of view on the news? You're not alone. The Campaign for Democratic Media is a nonpartisan, nonprofit group fighting to ensure that our public airwaves represent more than just one voice. Canadians deserve diverse, accountable, and quality Canadian media. Visit democraticmedia.ca to learn how you can stand up for media issues.
Subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes. Subscribe via iTunes or at radiofreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com.
And we're back. It was 100 years ago the past Saturday that the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand of Austria set in motion a series of events that would eventually lead to the onset of World War I, the Great War, the war to end all wars, the war no one expected and yet everyone wanted. It was a time when technology and science lost their innocence, and a time that changed humanity more than any other single event in history. It was a tragedy so great that all nations agreed with on the creation of a supranational body, the League of Nations, that it must be created to prevent this ever repeating ever again. And it was the failure of this body that ultimately led to the repeat of World War just 20 years later. To mark the centenary of the First World War, we here at Radio Free Thinker are planning on an ongoing series of segments on each landmark event as it reached its 100-year anniversary.
When I send you a picture of Berlin, you'll know it's over, over there, I'm coming home.
Yeah!
10 million soldiers to the war have gone, who may never return again.
Yeah!
I didn't raise my boy to be a soldier. I brought him up to be my pride and joy.
To start the series, let's take a look back at what most historians view as the spark that eventually ignited the globe on fire, the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand. The Archduke was the heir apparent to Emperor Franz Joseph of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, also known as the Habsburg Empire, called so after the ruling dynasty. The Habsburg could trace their rule in Austria and much more over the span of 600 years. Franz Joseph was an elderly, very conservative ruler that repressed the non-Australian, non-Hungarian population. This led to a lot of resentment, coupled with a general sense of revolution that was an ongoing threat to the ever-aging monarchies in Europe, especially fueled by the crumbling Ottoman Empire. Tensions within the empire were very high during the first years of the 20th century. In contrast to his father, Archduke Ferdinand was a reformer who wished to transform the centrally controlled empire into a United States of Habsburg, a federation where minorities would be treated as equals and each region would gain a substantial autonomy. The other actors in this play are the Bosnian anarchist group known as the Black Hand. This flavor of anarchism believed that if you metaphorically cut off the head of the state itself would wither and die, thus leading to revolution and the freedom of oppressed people. Along with the Black Hand were Serbian nationalists who wanted to give the Austro-Hungarians a black eye and thus allow Serbia greater freedom in the region and paved the way for Serbian union with Bosnia. It was these collaborators, some of them high-ranking Serbian military officers, that was the root of the casus belli of Austro-Hungary against Serbia. It should be noted now that Serbia gained its independence from the Ottoman Empire in 1867. At the time, it was also attempting to reunite with Bosnia to form the United Serbia in 1876. I say attempted because although the great powers acknowledged Serbia as a nation, it prohibited from reuniting with Bosnia. It was given to Austro-Hungary in the Congress of Berlin that ended the Russo-Turkish War. Serbia was, on the eve of World War I, riding very high after two Balkan wars that almost doubled Serbian territory, largely at the expense of the Ottomans. So the stage was set when the Archduke decided to visit Sarajevo in 1914 to open up a state museum. It was advised that he return back to Vienna because of the high tensions at the time. Why high? Ferdinand came to Sarajevo after observing military maneuvers in Bosnia, the same Bosnia most Serbians believed was stolen from them by the Habsburgs. So what actually happened that day 100 years ago? The Archduke was driven to the opening ceremonies in an open car. He was confident and likely wanted to show courage, i.e. he wasn't afraid of being assassinated, and trusted that the loyal people of Sarajevo would not harm their Duke. On the way, five members of the Black Hand attempted to bomb the Archduke's motorcade. Of the five, only one actually threw their bomb, and it hit the back of Ferdinand's car. It bounced and landed underneath the following car, where the timer set off the bomb, wounding about 20 bystanders. The bomb thrower attempted and failed to commit suicide, was beaten within an inch of his life by the crowd, and then arrested. The motorcade moved on to the next stop, the town hall. At the town hall, Ferdinand said, quote, "Mr. Mayor, I have come on a visit, and I get bombs thrown at me. It's outrageous." Then he followed by, "Now you may speak." The mayor gave a speech. The Archduke commented during the speech that he thanked the people of Sarajevo for their ovations and said, "As I see them, an expectation of joy at the failure of the attempt at assassination." The Archduke then canceled the rest of the day's activities so that he could go visit those people that were injured in the bombing. On the way to the hospital, the driver took a wrong turn, not being made aware that the original plans had changed. So instead of driving straight along Appel Quay to the hospital, he turned onto Franz Joseph Street towards the museum. Noting the mistake, members of the Archduke's entourage got the driver to stop and turn around, where the car stalled and was sitting there for several minutes. Meanwhile, one of the original Black Hand Five, Gavrilo Princip, thought he could get a second chance and took up a spot along the original planned route, spot just after the motorcade turned off of Appel Quay. Now, if they had done what they were supposed to do and go straight on to the hospital, Princip would once again have failed. But imagine his surprise when suddenly the Archduke was delivered up unto him and stopped in the middle of the street. This time, Princip did not freeze, but walked up to the Archduke's car and shot Ferdinand in the neck, and then shot his wife in the stomach, although he claims this was an accident. But both were dead before reaching any kind of medical treatment. Thus, the shot heard around the world, a shot that slowly, unexpectedly, and yet inevitably led to World War I, was sounded. Anti-Serb rioting broke out in Sarajevo and several other places within the Austro-Hungarian Empire within hours following the assassination. On the night of the assassination, a countrywide anti-Serb program and demonstrations were also organized in other parts of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Two Serbs were killed on the first day of the program in Sarajevo. Many were attacked, while around 1,000 homes, shops, schools, and institutions, such as banks, hotels, printing houses, owned by Serbs, were razed or pillaged. Most of the conspirators, including those who smuggled the assassins into Sarajevo, were arrested. Of the 16, only 5 were sentenced to death. In fact, the assassin himself, Princip, got 20 years. Why not death? Well, you see, under Habsburg law, no one under the age of 20, i.e., what passed as a minor at that time, could be sentenced to more than 20 years. He did eventually die in prison from tuberculosis, so perhaps some form of rough justice there. It was this one single event, though, that eventually snowballed into a greater and greater escalation of tensions, and then eventually war. And that'll be the subject of our next segment on this topic, about the actual political machinations that led to the actual outbreak of hostilities. And you know, this tale about the assassination of Ferdinand, it's so weird and so twisted, someone should probably make a movie out of it. I imagine they already have.
When I send you a picture of Berlin, you'll know it.
it's over, over there, I'm coming home.
Yeah.
10 million soldiers to the war have gone, who may never return again.
Yeah.
I didn't raise my boy to be a soldier. I brought him up to be my pride and joy.
We'll be right back after this break.
Another night's work well done. And so easy without that nuisance Spider-Man.
I didn't know you cared.
You!
Yes, Electro, and I'm going to short-circuit you once and for all.
You would have been better off in the hands of the police. You are no match for my power.
It takes more than power to win. It takes brains and knowing your enemy.
I'll pit my power against your brains any day. What was that?
That, my thieving fiend, is the result of brains.
Use your brain. Turn off all the lights when you leave a room. If every household in BC turned off one light bulb for 4 hours a day for 1 year, it would save enough electricity to power all the homes in Mission for an entire year. This Power Smart Play brought to you by BC Hydro Power Smart and CITR 101.9 FM.
The 6th Annual Queer Arts Festival runs July 24th through August 9th at the Roundhouse Community Center in Vancouver. The Queer Arts Festival is Western Canada's only professional queer arts festival with a curated visual art exhibition, a community art show, 3 weeks of cutting-edge performing arts events, and inspiring workshops for adults and youth. Visit queerartsfestival.com for complete event details.
We have returned. While I was doing research into the new prostitution law, I discovered a historical anachronism. The crime comic. While I was doing research into the issue, two oddities showed up. First, did you know, Criminal Code Section 172, everyone who, in the home of a child, participates in adultery or sexual immorality or indulges in habitual drunkenness or any other form of vice and thereby endangers the morals of the child is guilty of an indictable offense and liable to imprisonment for a term not to exceed 2 years. So literally, and I mean literally in a literal sense and not the new non-literal meaning of the word literally. Yes, I literally hate the redefinition of literally, literally speaking. Okay, sorry about that. So literally, immorality is a crime. On one level, I can understand that there should be a mechanism to remove children from an inhospitable home, i.e., if they have parents, parents who are drunks or drug users or abusive, sure, maybe they might be better off in foster care. If your mom or dad are sex workers, but are sober, non-addicts, provide a decent home, keep the sexual activities apart from the family area, who cares if they're involved in what moralists would call, quote, vice? And what does it mean to endanger the, quote, morals of a child? I can understand the life of a child, health, psychological development. Sure, those are things which society has a vested interest in, ethical interest to protect. But their morals? What does that even mean? First, I want to put on the record that I think religious indoctrination of minors is a form of child abuse. That telling a child that if they curse, question authority, masturbate, eat bacon, or work on Sunday, that they will be burnt alive for eternity. That is child abuse. Second, what endangers morals? If I teach my child that capitalism is wrong, that they should care more about each other, that resorting to violence, even against bullies, is not a virtue but a vice, well, you can't take my child away, even in the tortured logic of Harper. That I might understand. But you could arrest me and put me in jail for questioning the current moral standards of our society, at least according to this law. Under this standard, Martin Luther King would have been arrested, Gandhi, my socialist parents. Fortunately, the law seems to equate morality with sexual behavior. That it is immoral for a 17-year-old to give a blowjob to an adult, but completely moral for a train company to allow a train to destroy the downtown and lives of a small town. Okay, let's be fair. Let's make that it's moral for a corporation to pollute and destroy a natural reserve, i.e. the Jack Pine Mine Extension. For those who don't know about the Jack Pine Mine Extension, it is an open-pit tar sands mine in northern Alberta. An open-pit mine is not a pretty thing. It's not your classic mine where you have a small access hole on the surface and all the digging is done underground out of sight. An open-pit mine is just that. It's an open pit where they literally dig up the ground in ever-expanding circles to extract the bitumen. You end up with a large sterilized scar measuring football fields in size. Although the board that gave the project the green light stated that there would be significant adverse effects on certain wildlife and vegetation. The panel found the project would be a significantly adverse effect and cumulative impacts on the wetlands, species at risk, migratory birds, traditional plants, old growth forests, caribou, biodiversity, and Aboriginal traditional use of the land. It also acknowledged the likelihood of long-term negative cumulative impacts on the environment and traditional land use in the region. In spite of all of this, they found that these effects to be justified and that the project is in the public interest because the project would provide significant economic benefit. The world's current consumption is about 15 billion barrels a day and likely to rise over the next few decades. This mine is expected to recover, at best, about 325 billion barrels over the next 40 years. So, they decided to permanently ruin an environment, likely bring species into permanent extinction, and forever alter the people who currently call it home. They did all that for about 21 days of oil supply. How is that moral? And a sex worker who does no harm, if anything helps people, deemed immoral? And before I get the emails in there, yes, everyone knows that Gandhi and Martin Luther King were arrested, thrown in jail, but they weren't thrown in jail for moral reasons. They were thrown in jail for other, perhaps trumped up reasons. So it seems under the Harper regime, morality is not an abstract concept envisioned by Plato, Kant, or Russell, but more along the lines of Hayek, Friedman, or Rand. You can have as much morality as you can pay for. Okay, so that was one sort of area, and I could do a whole show about that. But another anomaly I discovered is a throwback to 1949 when the law was changed to make it a crime to have crime comics, or crime in comics was made illegal. If you read the section of the criminal code related to child porn, you will also see that it is illegal to sell, produce, or distribute crime comics. What is a crime comic? According to section 163.7 of the criminal code, a crime comic means a magazine, periodical, or book that exclusively or substantially comprises materials depicting pictorially the commission of a crime, real or fiction, events connected with the commission of a crime, real or fiction, whether occurring before or after the commission of that crime. Now, there is an exception for works that are in the public interest. So one might excuse Canada Vignette when they did a bit about Bill Miner. Yes, it was describing both a crime and how to perpetrate a crime, but it was also about how the term stick 'em up came into the English lexicon, a dubious, if not proud, moment for Canadians. The history of the law can be traced to our southern neighbors. The genre called detective comics, true stories, real crime, among others, were very popular in the 40s and 50s. Like anything new and popular, there was a conservative backlash. The ever so repeated lines that these comics are corrupting the youth, they will lead kids into crime, what about their morals, all came to force on comics. One book in particular, The Seduction of the Innocent, a title that in itself makes one wonder as to what the subject matter is. Well, the author warned that crime comics were a serious cause of juvenile delinquency, citing overt and covert depictions of sex, violence, drug use, and other adult fare. He asserted, largely based on undocumented anecdotal evidence, that reading this material encouraged similar behavior in children. Prior to this, the author, A. Frederick Wertham, was already preaching the ills of comics and hit pay dirt and the Canadian MP Davy Fulton, thanks to whose efforts resulted in the banning of these comics in Canada in 1949. Ironically enough, they were never banned in the U.S. thanks to a compromise by the comic industry to police itself. Perhaps the one-time self-regulation worked, if too well. But considering the imminent prospects of being made illegal, well, it can focus a corporation's mind. And thus was born the Comic Code, a show in and of itself. In the 1950s, the offense was tested by a group of comic book vendors in Manitoba. Mr. Rower, the chosen offender, was convicted of selling a crime comic, specifically number 62, April, Dick Tracy. The cover has, quote, drowning Tracy. Really, it looks like he's just kind of going to sleep. A villain shooting at him, just missing. There is a third figure who does seem to be a bit worse off, saying, I can't last, blub, blub. I have the comic up on the website so you can take a look and see how horrific the image was. And it really wasn't. By today's standards, very mild stuff. Hell, even for the time, it was very mild. I've provided another link where you can see some of the more questionable comic covers. Irrespective of the fact it was light stuff, and everyone knows Dick Tracy is not going to die, Mr. Orr was convicted of selling this crime comic. The Supreme Court upheld the law in 1953, stating that the image was, quote, bloodthirsty, and, quote, the legislation wished to enact laws to protect the children of this country from the evil effects of being subjugated to publications dealing with crime. Now, to be fair, the science of psychology and child development were, to strike a pun, in their infancy. But here we are, 65 years later, and technically crime comics are still illegal. Note I say technically, as in the laws on the books, but take a trip to any local comic shop and you will see things that will tingle your spine. Why are they allowed to sell them? Well, part of it is we now have a better understanding that graphic images are not likely to lead most people into wrongdoing, that those who are inspired were predisposed in the first place. Second, compared to the companions, movies, TVs, video games, the internet, well, even the worst comic is pretty weak tea. Of course, the biggest reason the cops don't arrest comic sellers is they know the case would be kicked out by the Supreme Court as an infringement on the Charter of Rights, a thing we didn't actually have in 1949. So there's lots of zombie laws on the books. Why have I singled this one out? Well, first, I didn't know of this, and I thought it was interesting in and of itself. But also because our government's just done a major and deplorable overhaul of the criminal code where this anachronism lies. How easy would it have been, while telling women that they are weak and evil for selling sex, to expunge this useless law? I guess there's not a lot of votes in it or something, otherwise I'm sure Harper would have jumped on it. Another classic example of Harper's way. Well, that's all we have time for this week. Tune into next week's show. We're going to be a bit more science-y based. We're going to do 10 scientific ideas scientists wish we would stop misusing. Cognitive biases, a rundown of them. And 10 new breakthrough technologies that you really ought to know about. And there'll be a few more and more interesting stuff as well. We're going to close out the show with that little vignette about Bill Miner and some web wisdom. It's a bit from Louis C.K. and about the origins of the word faggot. Take note, this may disturb some listeners. So this is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
I'd like you to meet Bill Miner, famous train robber. He was the first bandit to say, hands up. In 1906, though, things went wrong. They're just east of Kamloops, the Imperial Limited headed for Vancouver. Hands up, says Miner and his friends to the engineer. Take the engine and that car up the track. He took the wrong car. This was the baggage car, not the express car. All they could find was some liver pills. Soon after, a police posse took after them. Who are you? The sergeant asks. Prospector, says Bill Miner. But one of his friends panicked. Look out, boys, he says. It's all up. The police found a gun and a bottle of liver pills. Hands up, says the sergeant. Hands up.
I have running water in a toilet. That's all it took.
She seduced a harp player. harp player?
A harp player.
He goes, she's young, cute. He goes, oh, she doesn't work here. Waitresses there hate him since then.
Is that bad?
That's terrible.
You're my sister. And I want to do open mics.
Yes, honest to God.
Behind a Dunkin' Donuts. Okay. Okay, sorry.
Heal. All right. All right, two gets a nine, that's flushing. Queen gets a jack.
Hey, is this high-low?
Yes, it's high-low.
Is a seven of hearts, five,
what you can do with this seven? Shove it straight up your mother's shitmaker.
I don't think it'll fit up there. Her ass is so crammed with all those dicks she finds behind the bus station.
That doesn't even make any sense.
Well, see, what Nick is saying is that your mother goes to the bus station and she gets, like, old thrown-away penises there, like, out back where they keep those, like, in a bin. She does it so much, their ass is just crammed.
Your mom really does that?
I don't know. I don't talk to her every day.
Hey, man, let me finish.
All right.
And she just crams it in there and uses one of those coffee tampers, you know, for espresso machines.
I got it earlier.
Wait a minute. I'm not finished. Oh, really? And she just shoves them in there and just it's just compressed. Hmm. It's like she's almost crushing dicks into like a dick diamond, like a pink diamond. And so, you know, try to get a carton there.
Okay, that does make sense.
What's that feel like, anyways?
What?
The dick in the ass.
You're asking me because I'm gay?
No, I'm asking you because you're very learned. Yeah, I'm asking you because you're the only gay person here.
Are you interested for any particular reason?
You need a breath mint, my friend.
Hey, Rick, is it true there's a club in the city called Jerks, where gay guys just stand around all day and play with each other's dicks?
Yeah, City Jerks.
Oh, my God. What is wrong with you people?
Wait, there's really a club like that?
It's not a club, per se. It's like a floating party. It meets in different locations every week.
And what goes on there?
Jesus, do we need to hear this?
Why don't you just shut up and learn something?
Hey, why don't you shut up?
Nice one.
Don't want to.
Well, City Jerks is a gathering, sometimes in a hotel room, sometimes at a club, and, you know, different places. And it started basically when AIDS did. They wanted to have a club where guys could have, like, a group sexual outlet, but still play safe, you know. So at these meetings, they get together. Some guys go one-on-one. Some guys go in a huddle.
Like, do what? What goes on?
You masturbate each other.
Ah, Jesus.
I thought masturbation meant only one person.
So you just stand around in a room and you jerk each other off?
Yeah, that's why they call it City Jerks.
Well, you could just watch. A lot of guys like to watch while another guy pleasures himself.
Stop! Stop telling this! I'm gonna puke.
Is there a lesser charge for watching, like standing room?
No.
Like auditing a class?
No, because you never want to know.
What's a huddle? You said huddle. What's that?
It's a huddle where you huddle together in a group and everybody reaches in and you kind of help yourself.
To cocks and balls.
Sure.
Oh, my God. What are they in, a candy dish? Jesus Christ, what are you people thinking?
It's like a quarterback of the huddle, and he's like, you jerk him. You jerk him.
Break.
Well, on two.
On two.
What do you do if you're there and somebody recognizes you?
Say hi. Well, you'll be pleased to know. Everybody's naked. Except for shoes and socks.
Really? Why the shoes and socks?
Well, after a while, the floor is full of...
All right! I get it! Christ!
That much? Well, you got to put on some shoes? Like high, like Timberlands? You need some shoes?
No, just regular shoes with a rubber sole.
Sure. Something stylish, though, still?
You could. Florsheim has some stuff, you know.
Or snowshoes or something.
Flip-flops.
Flippers.
Flip-flops.
Mud cleats.
Mud cleats. That's another club. That's what a gym's club.
Mud cleats. You know, I know it's a free country, Rick, and I don't care what you guys do. But
thanks, Nick. Next time I'm about to go down on a big, juicy cock, I'll remember it's all right with you.
Well, like
you
I said,
have that stamped on the head of the cock.
Nick's
face.
Like I said, I don't care, and God bless you. But I got to be honest, what you guys do, it really makes me sick. And not on a political Bible level, either. I mean, just picturing you touch another guy's dick, that's gross.
Is that how you feel about what we do?
What, sex with women?
Yeah, do you get grossed out thinking about pussy?
I don't think about pussy. You know, I don't care what you guys do. You're the ones who asked me. And you guys ask me this shit every time I'm here. Really, I talk about gay sex more with you guys than I do with any of my gay friends. You guys are obsessed.
Well, I'm curious. I don't know that I'm obsessed.
Really? You, Who says faggot on stage more than you say hello?
Hello? Who says hello more than once on stage?
Who says hello on stage at all?
Yeah, hello.
I mean in life. In life he says more than he says it in life.
Okay. Rick, does it offend you when I say that word?
What word? Hello?
No, faggot.
Yeah, does it bother you when he says the word faggot?
No, it bothers me when you say it, because you mean it.
Yeah, but really, it's like, as a comedian and a gay guy, you're the only gay comic I know. Do you think I shouldn't be using that word on stage?
I think you should use whatever word you want. And when you use it on stage, I can see it's funny, and I don't care. But are you interested to know what it might mean to gay men?
Yeah, I am interested.
Well, the word faggot really means a bundle of sticks used for kindling in a fire. Now, in the Middle Ages, when they used to burn people they thought were witches, they used to burn homosexuals, too. And they used to burn the witches at a stake, but they thought the homosexuals were too low and disgusting to be given a stake to be burned on. So they used to just throw them in with the kindling, with the other faggots. So that's how you get flaming faggot.
So what you're saying is gay people are a good alternative fuel source.
So they get the term diesel dyke.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
You might want to know that every gay man in America has probably had that word shouted at them when they're being beaten up. Sometimes many times. Sometimes by a lot of people all at once. So when you say it, it kind of brings that all back up. But, you know, by all means, use it. Get your laughs, but, you know, now you know what it means.
Okay, thanks, faggot. We'll keep that in mind.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Jihad for Love, Whitewater Black Gold, A Red Girl's Guide to Reasoning, East Hastings Pharmacy, Ai Weiwei Never Sorry, Misrepresentation.
Cinema Politica UBC screens politically charged films with speakers and discussions every month. Screenings take place at the Norm Theater in the Sub and are by donation. To learn more, visit cinemapolitica.org/UBC.
Last night, I left the bar. I was thirsty, and I don't drink wine. I was desperate. I needed blood. I turned to the only place I could. The only place that could possibly help me.
What is this?
CITR 101.9 FM.
A center for ants! What?
We're a radio station broadcasting from UBC Vancouver.
How can we be expected to teach children to learn how to read if they can't even fit inside the building?
Visit CITR.ca.
Derek, it's just a...
I don't want to hear your excuses! The center has to be at least... 3 times bigger than this!
Robots need... love
to. This is Dan Mangan, and you are listening to CITR 101.9 in Vancouver and surrounding university area.
They want to be loved by robots. Need love to. They want to be loved by you.
Listen, if they're so hot, how come they're not tearing up the charts, babe?
Because you never play them, babe.
At CITR, our hosts choose the music they play. That means our charts actually reflect the tastes of music lovers, as opposed to focus groups. So if you want to know what's really tearing up the charts, get your hands on a copy of Beatroot or Discorder magazine, or go online to CITR.ca. CITR's charts are based on actual spins motivated by actual preference. No payola, no marketing, just good tunes. Refreshing, no?